WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. The third season of HBO's Deadwood is now out on DVD, so we thought it would be a good time to hear Terry's interview with one of that show's many standout character actors, Brian Cox. On Deadwood, Cox plays Jack Langrish, a theater producer who brings his traveling troupe of actors and hangers-on to the opportunistic, dangerous frontier mining town. He plans to convert an old bordello into a theater. In addition to his recurring role on Deadwood, Scottish actor Brian Cox has appeared in Spike Lee's 25th Hour and in The Bourne Identity. Before Anthony Hopkins played Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter in The Silence of the Lambs, Cox played Hannibal Lecter in the 1986 movie Manhunter. Terry spoke with Brian Cox in 2006. Before we get to their conversation, let's listen to a scene from the third season of Deadwood. Brian Cox, as Jack, is talking with old friend Al Swearengen, played by Ian McShane. They're plotting against George Hurst, the ruthless tycoon who owns much of the town. Jack's idea is to get close to Hurst by pretending to be a faith-healing masseuse. But Jack, being as theatrical as he is, doesn't exactly say it in those words.
Perhaps, Al, given the sleigh ride which ensues, the best connection to Leviathan may not be by harpoon.
Explain yourself.
I mean the inimical Mr. Hurst, suffering with discomfort at his back. The wiles of a bull such as oneself may have use as a feint to occupy him.
How?
Campaign towards relief. Protracted, punctuated by Pentecostal whoops and manual pushes and prods while invoking arcane authorities. The host's unhealthy soul, reliable to sustain his symptoms.
Brian Cox, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to describe your character in Deadwood.
I play a character called Jack Langrish. He's a character who actually existed. He's slightly different from the real character. He wasn't as flamboyant as perhaps I have, or David Milch has made him. And he's serving a clear purpose in the story of Deadwood. But he was an amazing man, because he was a man who toured theatre companies all over America during that particular time. And he had just lost everything and actually kind of like out of the ashes at the Chicago fire. He lost his company, and then within a week he had everything back on its feet again. He started off touring with about 15 people. He ended up touring with 115 people. He finally retired, and he died as a senator, I think, in Colorado. He was a really, really interesting man, and he was the first person to really bring theater to the West. He actually did, in Deadwood itself, he did the American premiere of The Mikado.
Oh, God. Excuse me, that has to register on me. To think of The Mikado in Deadwood, the way Deadwood is portrayed in the series, is really hysterical.
Yeah, it is. It's a kind of, it's so odd, really. But it was fascinating. He was a fascinating character. And so he comes now to Deadwood, and basically, I think, you know, we've arrived in the third series, and you know, if you look at the sort of graph and the path of Deadwood, you can see that culture, you know, having been through the whores and the boozing and what have you, and the kind of more basic things that was required in those mining camps, the miners themselves, of course, sought culture. They wanted theatre. They wanted, you know, they wanted burlesque, but they also wanted straight theatre. So, you know, language serves a need.
Because your character is a man of the theatre and very into theatre, when he's just having a conversation, he often sounds like he's proclaiming on a Shakespearean stage. You've performed in Shakespearean productions. What is the difference between how you actually perform Shakespeare when you're doing Shakespeare and this kind of Shakespearean sound that you've given this theatrical producer in Deadwood?
Well, it's to do with the technique of how to speak, for a start, how to sustain a thought on one breath. Shakespeare is all about breath as thought, but a lot of his cadence is very, very long. You know, the iambic carries you through, and I mean, there's a whole structure to how you play verse. But also, the idea is that everything is on the text. You know, the subtextual idea is a very, very 20th century idea, and it's a kind of thing that pervades American films, which is why we have this kind of Strasbergian effect, you know, this kind of, I think, basically phony Stanislavskiism, where the actors scratch and mumble and do all this stuff, and that's supposed to be real, you know. But the interesting thing about somebody like Langrisch is his language and his training and his craft and his appreciation of words infects him, and you get that with theatric types. I mean, it's slightly dying out in the way it was now, but I work, for instance, with John Gielgud, I work with Ralph Richardson, I also work with Laurence Olivier, and they had a cadence, they had an ability to use a phrase in a particularly erudite and extraordinary way. They were part of that breed of actor. And those Victorian actors excelled at it, absolutely excelled at it. It was the way they spoke. It was the way they thought. How they got up in the morning, that's what they started with till when they went to bed at night.
I want to get to another role that you've had. And this is just such a terrific performance. It was in the film The 25th Hour in 2002. This is directed by Spike Lee. And I want to play a scene here. Edward Norton plays someone who's about to serve a long prison term, and the film is set in the 24 hours before he has to report to prison. And this is like the last scene of the film. You play his father, you own a bar, you're driving your son to the prison down a long country road, driving him from the city to the country where the prison is. And his face is beaten raw. He's actually had somebody beat him up so that he wouldn't look too pretty or too weak and innocent when he got to prison. So he's sitting in the car with his face beaten up. You're driving, and then you say to him, just give me the word, and I'll take a left turn, and we'll find a nice little town that you can hide in instead of reporting to prison. So here's some of that scene we'll pick up right after you've made that offer.
If you want it, if that's what you want, I'll do it.
Oh, I'd take your bar.
My bar. Jesus, my bar. They can take my bar to hell and back. You think my bar is more important to me than you, my only child? Give me the word and we'll go.
They'll find me. They'll find me sooner or later.
You know how they find people? They find them when they come home. People run away, but they usually come back, and that's when they get caught. So you go, and you never come back. You never come home. We'll drive. We'll keep driving. Head out to the middle of nowhere. Take that road as far as it takes us. You've never been west of Philly, have you? This is a beautiful country, Monty. It's beautiful out there. Looks like a different world. Mountains, hills, cows, farms, and white churches.
It's my guest Brian Cox with Edward Norton in a scene from the film The 25th Hour. That is such a beautiful scene, and it's as if you're reading a poem with music behind you. So can you talk a little bit about doing that scene? Your monologue there lasts nearly 7 minutes.
It was an amazing thing. We you know, the monologue was rewritten. It was actually rewritten on the day we recorded it. I mean, we did one version of it early on, and then we just did this other version because Spike fell in love with the whole idea of this redemption, regenerative, you know, thing that could happen to Ed's character. So he wanted more stuff. So David Benioff, who wrote the script and also wrote the original book, wrote this, I think it's in the end, it's about a 10-minute monologue, and it was quite amazing. And we just did it. You know, we did the scene, of course, with Ed and I, and then it goes in, it kind of makes a seamless change into the monologue. And it's just an extraordinary, I think it's a truly, truly extraordinary film because it deals with so much. Again, it deals with, you know, because it was the first film to deal with directly with 9/11 in a scene where they the two boys are down in Lower Manhattan, and Spike had the guts to kind of pan through the window and he looked right down at Ground Zero, and it kind of gave the film an edge and a whole paean and kind of homage to America. And when I hear that script now and I hear the fact of the celebrating of what is beyond Manhattan, what is beyond that place, it's just it's so evocative and so poetic and so of the time. And, you know, I think it's a remarkable piece of work.
Brian Cox, you didn't really become well-known in the States until you were in, your 40s? When the film Manhunter came out in the 1980s, I think that was a kind of turning point in terms of American recognition.
Yeah, I was just in my it came out around about when I was, I made it when I was, I think, 39, and it came out when I was 40.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, you played Hannibal Lecter in Manhunter. What are some of the pluses and minuses of getting discovered by Hollywood when you're 40 as opposed to when you're in your teens or 20s?
Well, I think the obvious plus is that you're there. I mean, I've always wanted to be an actor for the long haul. I kind of realized that I started really quite young. I was 15 when I started working in the theater, and I went to drama school when I was just 17. I did my audition when I was 16. I was working as a professional actor from the age of 19. So, you know, I was very aware that, and I think it's my Scottish canniness, I think it's what stands me in good stead. I was very aware of the fact that I would be, you know, that while I know it's an insecure profession, it's something I want to be doing down the road. And the irony is, of course, as you get older, well, actually, it's not ironic, because it's a fact of life. You know, experience comes to you. So the thing that's more interesting is as you get older, because you have been dealing with life. So in a way, your work gets richer, and you know more about your job, and you're able to offer more. And the most interesting work for me is the supporting work. You know, in the theatre, I'm a leading actor. And I will always go back to the theatre and assume that role, but I can do it less and less because it's expensive. But in the cinema, it's knowing where your place is and knowing that you want to be a supporting actor. So you come in and you give the colour to a movie in a way. You know, because I've got colleagues back in England who say, well, I could never play small parts in films, you know, or anything like that. And I just think it's a nonsense, really. I mean, Michael Powell once said the great thing about cinema is that there are no small parts or big parts. There are only short parts and long parts, i.e. you're on a film either for a long time or you're on it for a short time. But when you're on a film, whatever, you know, when you're there, that's you. You're doing it.
Brian Cox speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with Brian Cox.
I know your father died of cancer when you were 9, and your mother had some kind of breakdown and was institutionalized. Yeah. For how long was she institutionalized?
She was institutionalized for about, on and off, it was about 2.5 years, 2.5 to 3 years.
Was there ever a diagnosis?
Well, basically, she had, you know, she had a massive nervous breakdown, and she did try to commit suicide at one point, and I think just everything became too much for her, and she just completely physically and mentally collapsed, and they didn't know what to do with her for quite a while, and then they finally decided to give her electric shock treatment. So they gave her electric shock treatment over a period of about 6 or 7 months. And then she had to recover from that. So it was a kind of long, drawn-out process. And, you know, it was quite, I think it was very difficult for her. It was a very painful time for her.
So you must have had it pretty rough. I mean, by the time you were 9 or 10, you were in some ways almost orphaned because your mother was institutionalized, your father had passed away.
Yeah, I had these wonderful sisters who, I have 3 elder sisters, and I have a brother as well, a brother who's older than me. There's a kind of, the war is between us all. My sisters were born, I mean, I've got sisters who are 16, 15 years older than me. And they're still around. I mean, they're fantastic women, truly fantastic women. They were fantastic to me when I was a kid. I mean, they really were. They saved me. I mean, my childhood was great. I mean, in recent times I get a little bit... I get a little bit concerned because I seem to give the wrong message about my childhood. Actually, my childhood until my father died was really pretty amazing. I mean, my mother and father had problems, but they had problems which was to do with my dad made some, you know, he during the war he did quite well because he had a tiny shop and he made some very bad building investments and lost a lot of money, and that was in the background. But basically, we were a very happy family.
You left home when you were around 15.
I left home. I still lived at my home, but I was hardly ever there because I was working in the theater. I really left home when I was 17.
And did you leave home because you were unhappy there, or because you wanted to start looking at theater more seriously?
No. You know, when I left, it was really because I had a very strong accent, a very very strong Dundonian accent, and I had to go to drama school. And I wanted to go to drama school, and really in order to learn the craft of acting. And I wanted to go to London because I didn't want to go to Glasgow. I really, you know, I needed somewhere where I could learn how to speak, you know, what they call standard English, which I've never been able to speak.
What do you think of your accent as sounding like now?
Well, my accent is a sort of hybrid of so many things, you know. I think I've lived in England for, you know, on and off most of my life, but I've also lived in America. I mean, it's been very difficult because I've got this line in this play. I'm doing this Stoppard play in London, and I've got this line where I say to the woman who plays my wife, just, you know, who's had cancer, I say, and she's had a breast remove, and I say, just don't lose half your bum, that's all. And I keep saying, but. I get told off very firmly by the, it's not but, it's bum.
What about the accent or the dialect that you're using in Deadwood as the theatrical producer?
Well, that was originally, you know, it was so odd because I originally was going to play him American, but then I realized that he was indeed Irish. And there was a wonderful actor called Michael McLeamore. Michael McLeamore was the man who gave Orson Welles his first job. Him and his lover, who was called Hilton Edwards, ran the Gate Theatre in Dublin in the 20s. But Michael became this sort of grand dame because he was gay, but he was this very sort of, and he always wore full makeup, and he wore a black toupee. And actually, the irony was he wasn't really Irish, but he pretended to be Irish because he loved the Irish cadence and he loved that way of speaking, that wonderful way of speaking in that Irish voice. And so I kind of thought this was a very good kind of template for Jack Langrish. So I kind of used a bit of that.
Now, I've read that you've said that you don't like to watch your own movies, you don't like to see yourself on screen because it makes you feel like the Elephant Man. You said, I come across as a sort of creature. I never seem like a human being. And I'd like to hear more about that.
Well, it's funny. I've just been doing some ADR for Deadwood this morning.
ADR? And, what is
that? Looping, you know, doing some extra additional dialogue required is what ADR is. It's where, you know, it's where you dub yourself on a screen, you know, like they might change a line and you have to, you know, you have to watch yourself on the screen and there's a little white line goes across and you play the line. So I had to see myself. And I just go, you know, it's just so odd. I think your own, you know, when you're in the mirror, you know, if you pass yourself in the mirror, you're still, or you see a photograph, you're still. But when you see yourself in motion, all kinds of, your face does all kinds of odd things and takes on odd shapes. And I get kind of spooked by it. I really do. My wife, she keeps saying, no, you must watch your work, you know, you really must. And I did when I was younger, I did, because I was vain. And I think it's still vanity that goes, God, this guy's so ugly. You know, it is the Elephant Man.
You know, and what you're saying is true in your mind, but so untrue in reality. But the reason why I'm interested in this is that you're dealing with this as an actor, but I think like so many people just deal with this looking in the mirror in the morning. You know, that it's just such a a reaction that I think many of us have just looking in the mirror like that.
Exactly.
That's how I look.
Well, at least in the mirror you're still, but, you know, on screen you're moving.
Right. You even get to see how you look behind your ears and stuff.
That's
like
right,
that.
Yeah. And then you see a, you know, angle.
Well, Brian Cox, I wish you good luck, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a delight.
Brian Cox, speaking to Terry Gross last year. He's featured on the new third season DVD set of the HBO series Deadwood. This is Fresh Air.